It is 7:31, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Greg Benick and Sheldon Solomon. Greg is co-producer of the documentary Flight from Death, The Quest for Immortality, and Sheldon is a professor of psychology at Skidmore College. He is also author of the new book, In the Wake of 9/11, The Psychology of Terror, which is co-authored along with Jeff Greenberg and Tom Posinski. Greg and Sheldon, thank you for coming in this morning.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thank you, Mike.
Let me begin with you, Greg. Maybe you can tell us, what was the motivation in creating your documentary, Flight from Death?
Sure. I created Flight from Death in conjunction with my partner, Patrick Shen, out of Los Angeles. Patrick had been working on an early version of Flight from Death called Man in Search of Immortality about 6 months before I got involved. And he was doing interviews and walking around the earth, shooting different shots and whatnot of death-related images. And I had been working on a project called the World Leaders Project with Sheldon, who's sitting next to me right now. We had written letters to every leader of every country on the planet, all over the earth, inviting ourselves essentially to come and speak with them about the nature of human violence and what motivates human violence and how fear of death and fear of our mortality plays into human violence and violent behaviors. And Patrick had heard about that work and called me up actually to interview me for Man in Search of Immortality. And once we got on the phone, we realized that we had tremendous amounts in common. Both of us were essentially geeks who sat around reading psychology, philosophy, and anthropology books on any given Friday night rather than running around going to bars. And we were fascinated with what one another was doing, so we decided to work in conjunction on both fronts, meaning Patrick came along with us to visit with the president of Guyana when we flew to Guyana to meet with the president of Guyana. And, of course, I got involved with that film, which, of course, became Flight from Death, The Quest for Immortality, as we rewrote and wrote the script, essentially, and co-produced that project in full. So that's how that came about. But it was definitely a team effort that sort of came out of nowhere.
And, Sheldon, you have been working on these type of issues for quite a while?
Yes, that's right, Mike. My buddies, Jeff Greenberg and Tom Posinski, and I, in the late 1970s, were, as graduate students, just trying to understand the psychological underpinnings of violence and why it is that people have such a tough time getting along with folks that don't share their beliefs about the nature of reality. And quite by accident, we ran into some books written by a recently deceased cultural anthropologist at the time, Ernest Becker. Particularly two books, The Denial of Death, for which he won a Pulitzer Prize, I think in 1974, and another book called Escape from Evil. And we were very stricken or smitten by Becker's ideas, which are deceptively simple. He just says that only people are smart enough to realize that we're here. And once we realize that we're here, we also realize that we're going to die someday. And this is a potentially overwhelming realization that most of us are quite happy to try and kind of put to the side, psychologically speaking. In technical terms, we repress it. We're so afraid of death that we can't bear to think about it in any explicit or conscious sense. And so according to Becker, what people did way back to reduce concerns about death is to create and maintain what we today would call culture, just beliefs about reality that people share to provide them with a sense that individuals have value in a world of meaning. Just the idea here is that everybody wants to believe that they're a valuable participant in a meaningful universe. And the problem, though, is that there's lots of different ways to understand the world. So according to Becker, if your beliefs about the nature of reality kind of help you out psychologically to reduce your fear of death, then when you run into somebody who's different than yourself, well, that's a problem, because if they're right, then you're wrong. And so according to this analysis, when we run into people that are different than ourselves, the first thing that we do is to just disparage or belittle them. And next, we try to get them to dispose of their beliefs and adopt ours instead. And then finally, if that doesn't work, just kill them and prove that your God is better than their God after all. And so as simple as it sounds, according to this analysis, it's really people's inability to accept alternative conceptions of reality that underlies a substantial proportion of human conflict.
So instead of what we look at a lot of the violence and mega violence that's done on a state level, instead of that really being, let's say, on a state level politics, it sounds like it's something that runs much deeper.
Yes, that's well put, Mike. Now, of course, we don't want to suggest that political factors are irrelevant. Clearly, we're in Iraq today because of petroleum. If it was the world's largest repository of dog feces, I don't think we would be overly concerned about what goes on there. On the other hand, when you step back and look historically at major confrontations that appear to have no solution, what you find is that generally there are confrontations between people that deny the right of the other to exist. And so Ronald Reagan, for people that go back that far, he called the Soviet Union the evil empire. And the Iranians, when they took over our embassy, they called us the great Satan. And our point is that these are not neutral political terms that lend themselves to kind of rational discourse and reasonable compromise, that they really show that what underlies all of this is a deeply psychological need to render oneself immortal, either symbolically or literally. But in so doing, we've got to destroy anybody who's different.
So, and you've done a lot of studies on this. I don't know if we should jump into that right now, but I'm curious.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's intriguing stuff. What is called a terror management theory. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, sure thing, Mike. Terror management theory is just our piece of jargon that we attach to our efforts to, in a scientific sense, prove the legitimacy of Backer's ideas. He won a Pulitzer Prize when he argued that unconscious concerns about death motivate a large proportion of human behavior. But what a lot of people argue, particularly in academic circles, is, well, we shouldn't take those ideas seriously. The guy wrote a book, and it might be interesting, but it doesn't mean that it's right. And so we were trained as experimental social psychologists, and we decided that we would try and prove that the ideas are right in the scientific sense of the word. So we developed a very simple paradigm that we call the mortality salience paradigm. But really what it entails is just having people think about themselves dying. Sometimes we just ask, hey, how are you going to feel when you die? And sometimes it's a little bit more subtle than that. We flash the word death so fast on a computer screen that people don't even know they're seeing anything. Other times we interview people in front of a funeral parlor or 100 meters to either side. So there's lots of different ways to get people to think about dying, even if they don't know that they're thinking about it. And then what we do afterwards, 10 or 15 minutes later, is we ask them to evaluate other individuals who are either very similar or dissimilar to themselves, or we put them in a position where they can behave in unfortunate ways towards folks that are different than themselves. And so in one very early study, for example, we had Christian participants either think about death or something else that was aversive but not fatal. And then we asked them to just make judgments about other folks they thought were in the study with them that happened to either be Christian or Jewish. And in the control conditions, there was no difference in people's evaluations of the Christian and Jewish individual. But after thinking about dying, the Christian participants liked fellow Christians a lot more, and they dislike the Jewish participants more. So what you've got is reminders of death making people more affectionate towards those who share their beliefs about the nature of reality and more hostile towards folks that are different. And we've done even scarier experiments that Greg and Patrick show in the film, where we demonstrated that if you give people an opportunity to be physically aggressive towards folks that are different than themselves, they will do so after a reminder of mortality. So there's now over 300 published demonstrations that reminders of death have a whole host of unfortunate consequences. And this work's been conducted by folks in 13 different countries. And the reason I say that is because it's not only been shown to influence the behavior of people in Western cultures.
Yeah, that would be one of my next questions is, is this just unique to us here in the West? But
Yeah, no, all over the planet. And one thing that we did with Flight from Death was attempt to show that these are, in fact, universal influences, regardless of culture or custom. So I know, Sheldon, you have a group of people who've done work in Australia with Aboriginal peoples as well.
Yes, we have some colleagues in Australia who went into the bush. I don't know if that's the right word for it, but they asked Australian Aborigines to either think about dying or something unpleasant as a control topic. And then they asked how eager they were to go to war against a neighboring tribe, and found that indeed Australian Aborigines reminded of death were much more gung-ho on attacking their neighbors.
Pretty fascinating.
So what does this kind of overall mean to us as a species? Because you're dealing also with two concepts of whether it's unconscious or, you know, outright conscious.
Well, I think that at least in our culture, primarily, it means we have to make some changes. We have to make them soon because we're imploding as individuals and as a culture in terms of our mortality and fear of our mortality and the effect that has on our behavior, both within the culture and the way that this culture interacts with other cultures. And I know that there's three things in particular that we need to think about doing in order to make those changes. One, of course, and you're helping with this today, Mike, is get the ideas out there, meaning that the more that people interact and interface with these ideas, the more they're going to become comfortable with them. And that sounds like a soft response, but it's actually more of a hard response, because I know, and Sheldon can speak to this, that the terror management team has found that when people are more comfortable with the idea of their own mortality, that negates the mortality salience effects, meaning that if they're comfortable with their own mortality, that reminding them of death and then causing them to come up against somebody of differing cultural background, that the violent or negative or aggressive effects are diminished. That's what you found, right?
That's
Sheldon?
Right.
Yeah. So interfacing with this material, whether through the film or through this weekend's conference at the UW or through ErnestBecker.org, which is the website of the quite local Ernest Becker Foundation, who promote his work worldwide, interfacing with this material actually can diminish violence, I'd even venture and go out on a limb to say, without any hesitation whatsoever. And I guess also just constant reminders that we are all related and we are all very close to one another in terms of our in terms of individuals in our species and in our interrelationships is an important thing that can be done as well. Reminding ourselves constantly that we are closely related to the person next to us. You know, it's true that all human beings alive today are descended from the same pool of 2,000 proto-humanoids. And, you know, Sheldon has mentioned to me recently, you know, any two people walking down the street in Seattle are more closely related than any two monkeys sitting in the jungle in Africa because of the just the way that our species has streamlined over the last, you know, few, you know, million years and whatnot. So the point being that reminding people that we are, in fact, much closer related than you might think at first glance, that also negates mortality salience effects, meaning the effects of violence that result from reminders of death as well. So reminding of us of our commonality and reminding us just to maybe to have death reintroduced into our daily lives or just to come to terms with it, those can actually have profound anti-violent effects in terms of our behavior.
And what do you attribute the current level of violence, both worldwide in terms of like wars, as well as in this society, it seems like violence is at an all-time high of people going against people?
That's a great question, Mike. And to be silly, of course, if I could answer it, I'd not be here. I'd be chugging rum out of a coconut on the beach with my Nobel Prize. But these are indeed interesting historical moments. And I think it would be imprudent to just try and think in terms of one singular cause. Having said that, though, I think a case could be made that we really are on the cusp of the crossroads of human experience, to get back to what Greg was suggesting. And it's not a new idea. Actually, the philosopher Nietzsche at the end of the last century and two centuries ago, you know, had the famous utterance that God is dead. And I know lots of folks have heard that phrase, but very few have gone on to read what Nietzsche said. Right after that, in the same paragraph, Nietzsche said, look, the next few hundred years are going to be very, very volatile, because the traditional beliefs that have sustained Western culture for thousands of years have now been undermined by modernity, basically the Judeo-Christian tradition, which had been very, very central to most of Western civilization for thousands of years. Had been undercut by Darwin's ideas, by the Industrial Revolution, just by changes in the sciences like Einstein's relativity and so on. And so what some people say is that what we're kind of witnessing is the breakdown of common beliefs that have held us together for lots of years, but we've not yet replaced them with any viable alternatives. And so things can go either way. On the very dire side of things, in his book Escape from Evil, Becker says, you know what, I don't know if we're a viable form of life. As hideous as it sounds, he speculates that maybe in the long run, to be alive and to know it isn't such a good idea. And that was okay until we developed the kinds of weapons that would allow us to exterminate each other in relatively short order. On the other hand, things could go the other way. Even though life is gruesome right now, it's often the case that humankind does not make substantial changes in the way they conduct their affairs until driven to do so by necessity. You know, we know the phrase, necessity is the mother of invention. And maybe things do need to get to a sufficiently dire point such that we have no choice but to reconsider our basic values and what we really mean when we talk about progress, and how it is that we organize ourselves, as Greg said, both as individuals and as societies and as groups of societies in the context of our participation in a global community.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one important thing, especially since we're talking about death and dealing with death, is not to maintain a doom and gloom attitude. I know
that's
that
right.
Flight from death doesn't end on doom and gloom, and the Ernest Becker Foundation doesn't deal in doom and gloom, and terror management isn't about doom and gloom, but rather hope and you know the idea that we could actually create a life and a world that's better for all people, not just for Americans and or Westerners, but for people as individuals, meaning uplift ourselves individually and in line with that cause us as individuals to act better towards other individuals, thus creating a better society and better world, as as lofty and overtly pleasant as that might sound. I mean, quite literally, that's what we're trying to do, is make our lives easier to live, more enjoyable to live, better to live. So it's important to remember that even though we're talking about death here, that we're not talking about death with a capital D, but death with a small D. Let's talk about life with a capital L, more importantly.
And I know in your film, Greg, that a couple of the concepts that come up that seem pretty important to this whole process is the ideas of the culture that you are part of, and then the idea of the symbols within that culture. So do you see as a restructure or redoing the hierarchy of what symbols we see as important, as key to solving this?
Absolutely. I mean, when the dollar sign is the most important symbol in our culture, that doesn't say much to me about life. In fact, it speaks quite to the opposite. So I would suggest, and again, I'm not a child psychologist, although, you know, I've done a little bit of reading, but I mean, I would suggest that introducing ideas about death to young people in our culture, and just making it such that death isn't something that happens behind closed doors only, might inspire people to grow up wanting and demanding different symbols in our culture, not necessarily connecting with symbols directly related to death and lack of life. People will grow up, an entirely new generation will grow up wanting new symbols, new images that reinforce what they've been brought up to understand, which is that life is a complete process that includes death as well. I don't have that. I mean, before we started working on the film, had very little knowledge and awareness of death in actuality. I mean, it's just not something that we see on a day-to-day basis in our culture. Wouldn't you agree, Sheldon?
Yeah, I would, Greg. And what I would add to that, because I think that's a great question, Mike, and a very important point, is that As we think about what is important symbolically to us as a culture, I think we need to pay particular attention to what it is that we value and teach our children to value, because right now we're in an awkward situation where the things that we value are not realistically attainable to the average citizen in our communities. As Greg said, the dollar sign is of great importance for women. To be physically attractive and be skinnier than a piece of linguine is of great importance. And so from minute one, we teach people, if you're any good, you're going to have a boatload of cash. If you're a woman, you've got to be thin enough so that I can floss my teeth with you. And that's just not going to happen. Most of us are not going to be as well off as Bill Gates, and we're not going to be as slender or attractive or young as the Kate Mosses of the world. And therefore, it's not surprising that America right now is a petri dish of psychopathology. We've got about a third of our citizens are depressed. Another third are addicted to drugs and alcohol. And the other third are at Walmart trying to buy a chainsaw and a lemon. So it's not a pretty picture. And I think it's not in part because we do have symbols that are simply not effective at this point in our historical moments.
I want to ask you, Sheldon, about your latest work, that on voting and suicide bombers.
Yeah, we've done a line of research, Mike, since the events of September 11th that I think are quite important, although for me, frankly, these findings are quite discombobulating. Most Americans know that after the events of September 11th that the popularity of President George Bush went very much higher than it was prior to September 11th. In fact, 2 days before September 11th, 2001, President Bush had the lowest approval rating in the history of any standing president, not in a time of war or depression. And he has been very popular ever since, not today, but he managed to win re-election. And what we thought was that American support for the president was not so much based on a rational cogitation about his policies. In fact, his average supporter can't accurately articulate what it is that the president stands for. And so we did a series of studies where they're very simple. We asked people to either think about dying or to think about something else negative. And then we asked them who you're going to vote for. And this was just prior to the last presidential election. And what we found was quite astonishing because in our control conditions, people favored John Kerry over George Bush by a considerable margin. In fact, in one study conducted in New Jersey with registered voters, they favored Kerry over Bush by a margin of 4-1. However, if we asked them to think about dying, or if we asked them to think about the events of September 11th first, then they favored Bush over Kerry by a margin of almost 3-1. And it's no secret that President Bush used the events of September 11th relentlessly as a political tool, but what our research shows is that it worked. People in their right mind, psychologically speaking, at the risk of annoying some of the listeners, in the sense of not being in a defensive state, they clearly did not favor Bush or his policies in Iraq. However, when they were reminded of their mortality, they had a radically different perception of the president and his policies. And we just finished a line of work with an Iranian colleague that showed that these effects are not confined to the American electorate. In Iran, we had people either think about dying or something else unpleasant. And then we asked them for their opinions about suicide bombers. They don't call them that in Iran. They call them self-sacrificial behaviors. But after, in control conditions, Iranians were not overly enthusiastic about suicide bombers. And not surprisingly, they had no desire to become one. But rather scary was that after a reminder of death, Iranian participants were more supportive of suicide bombers, and they were more willing to sign up to become one. And that's a really scary finding. And then we went back to America, and we did another study where we asked people to think about dying or something unpleasant. And then we asked, how much are you eager to use chemical weapons or nuclear weapons in preemptive military strikes. We just said, hey, should we do this? And if we could catch Osama bin Laden but needed to kill tens of thousands of civilians in the process, should we do it? And what we found was quite sobering, because in this case it was conservative Americans, and not liberal ones, but conservative Americans, after a reminder of death, were much more eager to use nuclear and chemical weapons, even if we had not been previously provoked.
Pretty fascinating. And one thing that comes to mind, Sheldon, just out of curiosity, since we're speaking about, in general terms, current events, more specifically, what do you think the effects are of the last year, the tsunami and Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita, on the American public? In what way does that affect our perceptions of death, or more importantly and more specifically to the point, our reactions to it?
Good point, Greg. That's undoubtedly a tough one and a complex one. Very simply, though, I would suggest, as common sense masquerading as psychological insight, that tsunamis, earthquakes, and those kinds of natural disasters are real live reminders of death, and they should produce the same kinds of reactions that we get in our studies when we ask people to think about dying. So there should be a much stronger support for whatever beliefs one holds dear to begin with.
Great.
I want to make sure we only have a couple minutes left that we talk about the conference that's happening this weekend that you are both speakers at. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. It's called Existential Openings at the Threshold of Death. It's a three-day conference on end-of-life care that's co-sponsored by the UW Departments of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, Anthropology, Comparative Religion, Psychology, and the School of Social Work, in conjunction with the Ernest Becker Foundation. It's all going on at Kane Hall, and there's going to be speakers ranging from Sheldon to screenings of Flight from Death. A woman named Linda Ganzini is going to be speaking on the Oregon Death with Dignity Act and physician-assisted suicide. We have a talk by Dan Lichty. Dan's an associate professor of social work in Illinois at Illinois State. He's going to be talking about the potential for an afterlife and what that does to us psychologically, to either believe in such a thing or not believe in such a thing. There'll be a talk on depression, meaning, and dignity at the end of life. And this is a conference, like I said, at the UW at Kane Hall. People can find out more about it at ernestbecker.org. And it's for the general public. I mean, granted, healthcare professionals are going to have a profound interest in what's going on, but anybody who's been affected by death and how we can learn to die with dignity or die with a greater sense of awareness would find it fascinating. So if you've been affected by death, both personally or if someone in your family has been affected by death, I'd recommend going to ernestbecker.org and finding out more about it.
All right, and that's happening in room 220 at Kane Hall,
is that
correct?
Yeah, room 220 at Kane Hall. We're going to be screening Flight from Death there on Sunday, so people can come and see the film and actually learn more about the film as well at flightfromdeath.com. There's a link. That's the official website of the film.
All right, and for those people that don't have access to the Internet, is there a charge for coming to the forums?
Realistically, no one's turned away due to lack of funds, but it's important to check the donation fee schedule, because the Ernest Becker Foundation is a nonprofit organization, relies on donations. So,
but everyone should come.
Everyone's
welcome.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And Sheldon, you are speaking there this morning, is that correct?
I speak in less than an hour as soon as I sprint back and write a talk.
All right, and Greg, your film is has shown at numerous film festivals, but how can people get a hold of that? Is that just through the...
Sure. There's a couple different ways. They can go to flightfromdeath.com. It's also available in-store at Tower Records and the Virgin Megastore nationwide. Barnes & Noble and Borders and Amazon.com all carry it. You can rent it from Netflix. Copies will be available through the Ernest Becker Foundation here at the conference at the UW this weekend. So there's a number of outlets. If you do a Google search for Flight from Death, if you can't remember flightfromdeath.com, the irony there notwithstanding, being able to type it into the Google search window but not into the URL window itself, you'll be able to find it quite easily.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.
We have just been talking with Greg Benick, who is co-producer of the documentary Flight from Death, The Quest for Immortality, and Sheldon Solomon, who is professor of psychology at Skidmore College and co-author of the new book In the Wake of 9/11, The Psychology of Terror.